Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Yıldız Digirmenci, and I'm Associate Editor of the e-learning platform EAN Campus. And besides that, the head of Department of Neurology in Istanbul Health and Technology University, Turkey. This month, our EAN cast is peripheral neuropathy is a topic of the month. Today, we are talking about the classification of peripheral neuropathies, and our guest is Dr. Panagiotis Sis. He is Assistant Professor of Neurology and Clinical Neurophysiology at the University of Cyprus. His clinical and research interests include peripheral neuropathies, clinical neurophysiology, and pain. We are very happy that he could have the time to join with us today for our podcast. Welcome, Panagiotis.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me today with you.
We are very happy to be with you today. So, just to start with, I'd like to talk about the definition of peripheral neuropathies. Could you shortly explain what peripheral neuropathy is?
Of course, peripheral neuropathy is an umbrella term referring to diseases or disorders of the peripheral nerves. This includes mononeuropathies, a term which we use to refer to conditions affecting single nerves. For example, median neuropathy at the wrist, we often call this as a carpal tunnel syndrome, or ulnar neuropathies at the elbow, or known as cubital tunnel syndrome, but also diseases affecting more than one nerves, which we call polyneuropathies.
Okay, thank you for the great start. So what are the clinical symptoms of peripheral neuropathy? Speaking of symptomatology, when should the clinician suspect of the diagnosis of peripheral neuropathy? Can you please give us some clues about that?
Of course, the clinical phenotype of peripheral neuropathies varies significantly from patient to patient and mainly depends on the exact type of the neuropathy and the degree of involvement of the different nerve fibers. Just to remind you that the nerves in our body are like cables. If you cut a cable and you remove the plastic around the cable, you will see numerous copper wires. In our nerves, these copper wires correspond to the nerve fibers. So initially, we can classify these nerve fibers into motor or sensory fibers, and based on their diameter, the fibers will be classified further into large or small fibers. The motor fibers are large in diameter and myelinated, whereas the sensory fibers can be either large in diameter, like the myelinated A-alpha or A-beta, or small in diameter, like the myelinated A-delta or the unmyelinated C-fibers. So the symptoms of peripheral neuropathy depend on the degree of involvement of these different fibers. Small fibers transmit signals relating to pain, thermal perception, but also can be sympathetic fibers innervating the sweat glands. And therefore, small fiber involvement may manifest with neuropathic pain, abnormal thermal perception, or sweat dysfunction in the form of either dry skin or hyperhidrosis. On the other hand, dysfunction of the large fibers will usually manifest with numbness, tingling, pins and needle sensations, abnormal proprioception, which may lead to severe sensory ataxia. And usually in more advanced stages, when motor involvement occurs in polyneuropathies, the patient may present with motor symptoms like muscle atrophies, cramps, or fasciculations.
Oh, great. So you summarized a bit of the neurological findings related to the symptomatology, which is so great. But if you please mention it again as a list of neurological examination findings, what would the clinicians find when they see a patient with a peripheral neuropathy in neurological examination, I mean?
Yes, of course, the symptoms that the patient complains of will raise the suspicion of peripheral neuropathy. But the neurological examination, as you mentioned, is very, very important in making a diagnosis. So as clinicians, when we suspect peripheral neuropathy, we need to seek evidence of reduced sensation, for example, reduced pinprick sensation, reduced vibration sensation, reduced touch sensation. We need to ask whether the patient does experience neuropathic pain. Usually this happens in a length-dependent fashion. So the first symptoms that the patient will complain of is a burning feet or painful feet. The pain may also accompanied by itching, electrical shock-like sensations. And in more advanced stages where the proprioception is severely affected, the patient may have balance problems, what we call sensory ataxia. Checking the reflexes, we will find reduced or absent tendon reflexes. Usually the first to go are the ankle reflexes. And if we suspect motor involvement, we look to investigate for muscle atrophies. Particularly, this affects the distal muscles in the feet. And we need to investigate for any presence of visible fasciculations.
Well, thank you so much. So, considering this complex and kind of heterogeneous group of symptomatology and neurological examination findings, do we have a diagnostic algorithm? Do we have a pathway to follow when diagnosing the peripheral neuropathies? For example, are there any recent diagnostic criteria that you can share with us for the peripheral neuropathy diagnosis?
Well, for the diagnosis, we follow the symptoms that the patient complains of. We may use in our practice specific forms to make a diagnosis, a checklist of symptoms. But clinical examination at the moment remains the gold standard of diagnosis, of clinical diagnosis of the neuropathy. However, nerve connection studies will make the diagnosis definite. So what we use in our practice is that if the patient has absent or reduced vibration sensation in the big toe or the ankles and reduced ankle reflexes or absent ankle reflexes bilaterally, this makes a diagnosis of polyneuropathy, the typical length-dependent polyneuropathy, quite probable. But for the confirmation of neuropathy, we do recommend electrophysiological evaluation. In our laboratory, we do nerve connect studies in one upper and one lower limb. And if abnormal, we check the other side too. For the upper limb, we usually do check the sensory and motor connect studies of the ulnar and median nerve and the sensory connect study of the superficial radial nerve. Whereas in the lower limb, we check the sensory and the motor connection studies of the peroneal nerve, the motor connection studies of the tibial nerve, and the sensory connection study of the sural nerve.
Oh, great. So relevant to your answer about the importance of electrophysiological studies, neuroconduction techniques and others in the differential diagnosis and the diagnosis of peripheral neuropathy. How important it is classifying and differentiating the peripheral neuropathies. Would you please deepen into it a bit for us about clues in the electrophysiological examinations findings that will be supportive of peripheral neuropathies? Would you please deepen into it a bit? Because you mentioned small fiber neuropathies, large fiber neuropathies already. Do they differ?
It is really amazing how many wrong diagnoses of polyneuropathy can be given based only on symptoms and sometimes clinical evaluation. So we do recommend, at least in the first visit of a patient where we suspect peripheral neuropathy, to have a full electrophysiological evaluation, which consists of nerve conduction studies. The nerve conduction studies will definitely confirm the presence of a large fiber involvement. And based on the pattern of the involvement, we will have the type of neuropathy, which will guide us further for testing for the cause of the neuropathy. Sometimes, of course, we might have normal nerve conduction studies, but the symptoms will be there. So in these cases, we should evaluate the patient for the presence of pure small fiber involvement, and there are electrophysiological tests which help us making the diagnosis of small fiber neuropathy, such as the QST, the quantitative sensory testing, the SSR, which is the pseudomotor skin reflex. We might use minimally invasive techniques like microneurography, or we might proceed to a skin biopsy when we suspect such a neuropathy. Well, of course, neurophysiology is very important, as will tell us initially whether a polyneuropathy is axonal or demyelinating in nature. In axonal neuropathies, what we see is low amplitude sensory nerve action potentials and low in amplitude compound muscle action potentials. Whereas in demyelinating neuropathies, we get slow conduction velocities, prolonged distal latencies, and prolonged F-wave latencies. I would like to mention that for the latter, for the demyelinating criteria, we need to follow the very strict criteria that have been published. Sometimes axonal neuropathies, which can also cause a mild slowing of the connection velocities, may be misinterpreted as demyelinating. On the other hand, electrophysiology can help us understand whether we are dealing with a typical symmetrical length-dependent neuropathy or a less typical asymmetrical neuropathy, which can be pure sensory, what we call a sensory ganglionopathy, or a sensory motor, which is a neuropathy that we call mononeuritis multiplex.
So you already covered all about the importance of electrophysiological findings. As I understand, it's so important to diagnose and a differential diagnosis, as you mentioned. Is there anything to do with the classification of neuropathies? Is there a recent classification guideline or categorization for the peripheral neuropathies, apart from small fiber neuropathies and large fiber neuropathies?
As you correctly say, initially we have to distinguish between a pure small fiber neuropathy or a large fiber neuropathy, which in fact is accompanied by a degree of small fiber involvement in the majority of cases. The neuropathies will be classified initially based on the temporal evolution of the symptoms into acute, where symptoms develop within days or a few weeks, or chronic, where symptoms develop over months. And then based on the pattern of and the pathophysiology, if you say, of the large fiber involvement, we will classify the large fiber neuropathies into axonal or demyelinating neuropathies.
It's been very helpful indeed. And now coming to the treatment procedures, would you please give us some clues about the treatment options, treatment algorithm in peripheral neuropathies?
Well, the most important thing for a clinician after a diagnosis of neuropathy is to identify the exact cause of the neuropathy. In the case of demyelinating neuropathies, which are diagnosed based on the slow conduction velocities, the diagnostic approach and management is completely different to the typical axonal neuropathies. And I think that this is a topic of a different podcast. But in chronic axonal neuropathies, which is the commonest type of neuropathy, we would expect some tests to have been done initially at the primary care setting, such as screening for diabetes, kidney, liver, and thyroid problems, vitamin levels. And in the secondary or tertiary center, when we see patients with peripheral neuropathy who are still undiagnosed in terms of the cause of the neuropathy, we might proceed to more extensive testing, like a full immunological testing, sometimes screening for cancer, especially if we're talking about a subacute neuropathy with usually an asymmetrical appearance. We might also proceed to imaging studies, and very rarely we might request a nerve biopsy in case of the possibility of a vasculitic neuropathy. Although acquired demyelinating neuropathies are generally treatable, the chronic acquired neuropathies of axonal type, we need to identify the cause and stop the disease progression, and this will help the patient with not getting worse, and then we have to symptomatically treat the symptoms that the patient presents with.
Well, Panagiotis, I think so far you covered all the, you know, challenging issues in peripheral neuropathy, starting from the diagnosis and the symptomatology and the treatment options. I personally am so grateful for this comprehensive and, in the meanwhile, very practical talk of yours. Thank you so much. Do you want to add anything? Because it's been very helpful for us. I believe that our audience loved it at all. Do you have any other words to mention?
Just to add that in terms of treating the symptoms of the patient, we can use both pharmacological and non-pharmacological approaches. So we tend to use antineuralgics for neuropathic pain, like the gabapentinoids or SNRIs or tricyclics. We may use drugs for the treatment of cramps, which are quite frequent in our patients, like magnesium or quinine. But we can also use non-pharmacological approaches. Usually these are used as add-on treatments, particularly for pain. And this includes spinal cord stimulation, TMS, and acupuncture with some evidence of effectiveness. I would like also to highlight that some neuropathic symptoms in a specific form of neuropathy called the gluten neuropathy, which is related to celiac disease, can be solely managed by following a strict gluten-free diet. And this is one of the examples why it is very important to screen our patients for the common cause of neuropathy, as we can definitely help them with easing the symptoms, but also not making the neuropathy worse if we remove the factor contributing to the pathogenesis of the neuropathy.
That's very important last sentence indeed, I believe. These are very important last sentences because you just mentioned the treatable forms of neuropathies that the clinicians should keep in mind and make some improvement with some dietary changes. So thank you again for making so simple this complex and heterogeneous group of disorders for us to understand Panagiotis. We enjoyed a lot, and thank you a lot for being our guest today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me today with you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.